Welcome. Hello.
Hi.
Shh, y'all. I'm Alon Stevens. I'm a producer at KUT. I'm also one of AIR's New Voices scholars. So it's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Ann Hepperman, our moderator. Little known fact about her is that she once made Ted Danson cry. I'll just let y'all think about that.
Huh?
So I'll just let y'all think about that while she's moderating here.
Okay. All right, great. Fantastic. Welcome. I told Alon to keep it short and sweet because I kind of hate really long introductions at panels. I like to just like get right in. But there is a little bit of business that we're going to attend to before we go in. Welcome to AIR's welcome. Where are we at? What are we at? Getting to Yes. That's what it is. The art of getting to Yes, or as I call it, producers like to call it, I need money. Editors like to call it, tell me what the fuck you're going to do. So we're here at Third Coast. We're going to pull back the curtain. You're going to see some of the inner mysteries of the editorial process. This session has been here at Third Coast for at least like 9 years. The goal is to strengthen the pipeline between AIR's rich network of talented producers, which you all are now 1,000 strong, and significant, you guys are significant, broadcast and digital outlets. So over this hour, here's what's going to happen. We're going to have three incredibly brave producers pitch three stories to these three editors. Then we're going to have a death match, and we're going to see who makes it and then like toss the losers like out the window. So it's really high stakes this year at Third Coast. So actually what we're going to do, you can laugh a little harder at my jokes. Just this is being recorded. So it is a performance. It is, in a way, like, it's unusual. It's like public torment for our benefit. Okay, thank you. So I just wanted to introduce our editors first. And by way of introduction, I'm going to ask them a question. I'm going to have them finish a sentence. So to my left, we have Bob Carlson from Unfictional. And so I want you to answer the question, when you pitch me, always...
Always give me a complete pitch. Be as detailed as you can. If you know the beginning, middle, and end of the story, use that. If you have some audio already, use that. And it's, you know, the pitch is a sample of your writing, so make sure that it's well conceived and well written.
Okay. Second sentence that I'm going to force you to complete. When you pitch me, never...
Don't get discouraged. If you're turned down, pitch again, and don't, you know, in relation to the first thing I said, don't give me an incomplete pitch. The worst thing is when someone says sentences like, they give me the beginning of the story and they go, to find out the rest, email me back. And it's like, no.
Trash. Delete. Yeah. All right, great, thanks. All right, and to the left of Bob, we have Lita Hartman from Latino USA. Okay, so first, when you pitch me, always, ..
Okay, always. Tell me the basics of what we need to know about a story. The characters, the story arc, the scenes you envision, the sound you envision. But more than that, tell me the gee whiz in it. Why is it relevant? Why is it unique? Why does it get you jazzed? What is there about it that everybody else would be interested in? The story. And always check your pitch for flow, for writing style, because how you pitch shows how you think and how you write and how you express ideas. So you want to kind of check that, too.
Mm-hmm. All right. And never. When you pitch, never, 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 never.
I really never have many nevers. But
guys are too nice.
But things that are not encouraged would include a pitch that's written in a very dry, academic, authoritative style. Because in radio, we want things that are ear-friendly and mimic natural speech and so on. So your pitch should sort of be along those lines, too. Never a half-baked pitch, which makes me think that the reporter hasn't really thought through their story idea too much. And, you know, this could be because my father was an English professor and I just have, like, grammar police DNA in me or something, but check your spelling, check your grammar. That kind of stuff is important also. So that's it.
Okay, great. All right, so to the left, the far, far, far left, we have Jamie York from Radiolab. All right, Jamie, you're up. When you pitch me, always, ...
Always be excited about what you're pitching and have thought it through. I think it's really just that simple. I think there are a lot of things you can get past us on enthusiasm and thoughtfulness.
Really?
Swear to God.
Okay. All right. I'm going to prod that a little later when we go into the session.
Great.
Okay. When you pitch me, never ...
Never pitch me a study. Never pitch me a topic. Never pitch me a theme you've thought of or something you've run into that is that general, that vague.
Mm. Okay. You probably get a lot of those. You probably get a lot of studies.
A lot of studies.
All right. Okay, so we're going to go ahead and start. We're going to start with Bob Carlson and Unfictional, and Debbie Nathan is going to pitch. But before we have Debbie come to the mic, I'm going to have every show talk about how... The reason I'm doing this, so I'm going to back up into my brain and then go. So the reason that I want them to tell you how they view the stories on their show and their show. Because a lot of times I think as producers and listeners, we have our own concept of what we think a show is. And then that show has a totally different sense of self. And so I think that's part of the reason why I'm asking you to describe what you think your show is and the kinds of stories that you accept. So, all right, on Unfictional.
Unfictional is a show from KCRW in Santa Monica, broadcast and podcast. It's a story. It's a program of stories that are generally narrative, generally first person, more or less highly produced. My ideal topics might be a little bit pulpy, a little strange. Things that have sort of a visceral appeal, like crimes, drugs, dreams, ghosts, death.
All the light topics.
Yeah, that have some emotion. Some of the stories are produced in-house, but one of the core purposes of the show is to be an outlet for independent radio producers. And so that's why I say generally this, generally that, because I get such a wide variety of people that do stuff for the show that the topics do... very widely, and the producers are sort of encouraged to highlight their own styles and their own way of working rather than to be forced into a hardcore format. But we do work with producers to varying degrees, and they are, at a final stage, are turned into sort of the tone of the show. We want it to follow somewhat of a tone to keep the show somewhat consistent. And it's kind of a very informal and organic process. We are very small. It's only me and my part-time associate producer, Nick White. And so we very much work with the person in the way that person likes to work or works well.
All right. So first up, we have Debbie Nathan. And just so you know, the rules, you have 5 minutes, and I will give you a one minute warning.
I think there are some ghosts in the story, maybe some historical ghosts, but I'm pitching a story about acceptance, about the pain suffered by a people from lack of acceptance, and about some of that people seeking acceptance at any cost, even when it meant hurting another people. And about a little small offering of apology, which may or may not be accepted. So I need to say that I'm Jewish, and when you come from a group whose major claim to fame is that we're different, religiously different, righteously different, social justice different, Passover, escape from Egypt, and slavery different, it can be kind of hard to explore the fact that sometimes your people have wanted so badly to be accepted that they haven't been very righteous at all. Four of my Jewish great-grandparents they came from Europe, but instead of going up north, like to New York City, they went to Mississippi. And one couple had a little country store. And years later, my southern great-great-cousin, who went north and never came back, wrote this novel in the 1930s about our family. And the novel says that one of my great-great-grandparents fought in the Confederacy during the Civil War, and... the family owned two slaves. When I was a kid, we had this kind of tattered copy of the book lying around, and sometimes we'd have these family reunions, and you know, they'd bring it out, and nobody believed that we had slaves. And I can remember, nobody believed the Confederacy part either, but I can remember my father saying, oh no, you know, that's a novel, that's fiction, that's not true. Well, 2 years ago, like a lot of middle-aged people, I joined Ancestry.com. And you can look up all kinds of census and other documents, and very quickly I learned that my great-great-grandfather did fight for the South, and the family did have two slaves. They had two females, a 23-year-old and a 13-year-old. And so, you know, immediately I'm starting to think about some really dark things. I'm thinking about miscegenation. I'm thinking, what was my great-great-grandfather doing with those two female slaves? And did I now have cousins of color? So I typed my family's last name into Ancestry. It's kind of a weird last name. It's C-A-R-B. And sure enough, you know, all these black people popped up in the South in older censuses. And I kept on doing research, and I learned that Jews were a very tiny population in the antebellum South. They were maybe less than 30,000 out of 10 million people in the South. And they were only a tenth of the Jewish population in the whole country. But they were very happy in the South. They were actually treated much better. In the North, they were typically characterized as shifty money grubbers, and in fact, the worst anti-Semites were the abolitionists. So, you know, in the South, they were very welcomed by other whites, and after the oppression of Europe, they really yearned for acceptance, and that meant owning slaves, just like everybody else. So, you know, today, these Southern Jews' descendants are all over America. I'm sure that there are many of them even at this conference. I haven't found any other Jews, I've been working on this for 2 years, who have talked publicly. They've, like, examined their own family history. I think that my show would be the first program publicly discussing this. And, you know, it's very scary to explore the history because the good research shows that Jews were involved with slavery in exact proportion to their very small numbers in the South, and that, you know, obviously is a problem. But for decades, everybody from David Duke to Farrakhan of the Black Muslims has been accusing them of having been the big slave traders and slaveholders and the worst treaters of slaves. And the YouTubes are like, you know, there's videos all over YouTube. It's really pretty scary, and this kind of anti-Semitism has really discouraged public discussion, frank discussion of this. So my piece would talk about my efforts to recruit my Southern Jewish family, including some very elderly ladies in the South, to this search for black relations, and ultimately I didn't find any. But the piece would continue with my plan to visit Hillsboro, Mississippi, where my family lived with their slaves. My sisters and cousins want to stand at the crossroads of this little town with a sign, you know, that says, "We are Jewish, our family owned slaves, we're sorry." And we want to do this on the Upper West Side of Manhattan as well, so that we can interact with Jews. And we just want to see what people's responses would be and whether they would accept the apology.
Okay, so Debbie, you so stay because now you're going to have the conversation.
Yeah, that's really wild. That's a wild.
Oh, wait, applause. We're doing it. Come on.
At first, I was worried because a couple of things that made me a little worried at the beginning was it was a historical story, which is often difficult to do in a personal way, and it seems like a big story. When you're talking about this, the whole, you know, Jews in the South, and that's hard to do because, I mean, I try to as much as possible, no matter what the topic of the story is, that it's boiled down to a personal story. That, you know, even if it's like a big event or a big story, you have a one character that is sort of your guide through that story. So, would that be you?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, would the story be your? Were you running tape during any of this searching you were doing? Have you done any recording already on this?
I have. I consider it kind of pre-interview type stuff. But I've talked to a bunch of my relatives, including these old ladies that have the most wonderful Southern accents.
Yeah.
You know, and I did find some descendants of Jews in Louisiana. They're not part of my family. They're people who consider themselves black, who look exactly like I do, mm-hmm. who, you know, were the products of this kind of thing. But, no, I don't have a lot of tape yet. You know, yeah. this is a proposal to do the story.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, because you'd said you'd been working on it for 2 years.
I've done a lot of research. I got a lot of, there's plenty of Farrakhan tape on YouTube.
So, I mean, what is this, like, what do we hear in this story? Like, what is it, you know, you said the thing at the end where you're going to stand holding the sign. Is that sort of the end of the story? Is that the story? Or
I think that's the story. The story is, you know, the lead up to that, to us wanting to talk to people about this, wanting to talk to descendants of people in that community who my family enslaved, and talking to people, to Jews in New York who would be the kind of people who would think about this kind of thing if you brought it up to them and see what they have to say about it.
Because I almost see that more as like a scene, like the opener, maybe, mm-hmm. rather than the entire story. Mm-hmm. I would really be interested in hearing this history through your eyes as you were doing this search. Like, that's the story that I would want to hear, is that your search process, mm-hmm. and your discoveries, mm-hmm. and did you say you ultimately didn't find your...
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting story. At one time, we were convinced that there were people to look for, and, mm-hmm. I mean, I could tell you why I came to that conclusion. But, yeah, I mean, it's a long, you know, I have been involved with this for a long time, and every time you get a new document or every time you find a new person with little memories from the family, it affects me. So I see myself as the person who really carries the story, yeah.
And, I mean, would that be interesting to you to do that, a story that's sort of about your search?
Yeah, it would.
Because, I mean, it could almost be like where you... like I said, that you're standing with a sign, it could be, you know, what is this all about? I mean, which is what people would think when they came upon that, on you guys seeing this, and then this would be the backstory, right? I mean, are there the characters and scenes for you to do that kind of the story about your search?
You're talking about the search, or about the part with the signs? The search.
If I was going to do this, it would be the search.
The people that I think would be the characters would be my family, some of who are really interested in this and have regrets, and others who just aren't dealing with it. And then there are people that, in my research, I have found that people proudly put up stuff on Ancestry about how their family was from South Carolina, they were Jews, or their family was from Arkansas, and they were Jews, and they did wonderfully, and they have these huge genealogies. But then I look up their family on Amazon and see that they had lots of slaves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting to sort of see how they deal with that, you know, which they kind of don't. I mean, the fear of that and the shame of that, I think, can come out in among some characters, or the confused feelings about it. It's complicated. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even the idea of they had slaves because that's what everybody was doing. You know, that seems like what they would have said. Now, you know, I don't know if that, you know, but. I mean, have you met anybody who did have slaves and that did meet those?
I met a woman who found out in doing her genealogy that she had Jewish relatives in a tiny town in Louisiana, and she went to that town, and the people in the town said, oh, yeah, you know, go meet these people. They have Jewish blood. And she went to meet them, and they said, but, you know, most of our family here is actually black. And then it turned out that, yes, this was the exact dynamic from that period, from the antebellum. And so I met those people. I met mm-hmm. the descendants because I just wanted to meet them.
Yeah.
And I have good tape of them, actually.
And your story, and the story in terms of the historical aspect of it, like what, you know, what was going on in this time, would that mainly come from you, or do you have any ideas how that part of it could be told?
You know, there are a lot of documents, and there's some pretty nice music. There's sort of old Jewish liturgical music that can be mixed with Civil War, with Confederacy music, and there's tons of documents which have interesting language because mm-hmm. it's 19th century language, but it, mm-hmm. I think it would have to sort of be dramatized. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I mean, wanting to do the story would probably hinge on that, whether we could figure out a way, and I'm totally happy to talk about that at some point, if we could figure out a way to make it have a little, you know, have some more opportunities for scenes and action that is not just reading from historical documents or people nowadays just sort of reflecting on that on the past, which of course is important, but I probably would want a little bit more of the story of the search, a little bit of the detective story about uncovering the details of the story, too, and then leading up to that moment of, you know, standing on the corner of New York.
So repitch.
No, yeah. So I guess I'm going to say red, yellow, green.
Yellow.
Okay. Yeah. Good. Yeah. So okay, great. Yay. So I just wanted, before we go to the next picture, I want to reflect a little bit just on some of the elements of that pitch, because I think it's relevant to everybody here in the room. A lot of times we have stories about our families we think is really interesting, could have some kind of historical significance. And I'm going to throw this out. Jamie, what do you think makes a story, a personal story, worthwhile for a national show? You know, because a lot of times we're like, you think something is interesting because you were saying, I'm going to throw this back at you. You're like, you want enthusiasm. We're very enthusiastic about our families. And, you know, so many times we want those stories and we think they're important. And then they're not important for a national audience. What is it that makes a personal story resonate?
Yeah. It's one of the elements I think that we look for in all our stories, which is a kind of universality. I mean, I think whatever it is that you're seeing in that is familial has got to rise above somehow and speak to everybody else.
Maybe can you give an example of like a recent Radiolab?
Put me on the spot.
I know. Come on. Deliver York.
We just did a story. It was ostensibly a ghost story for Halloween. It was about a guy who had, after college, moved back to his small hometown and to his hometown house to live with his parents. He dropped out of college, wasn't really sure what he wanted to do. He wound up staying there for 6-7 years. Overhear his parents complaining that he was never going to leave. And he finally got mustered up the money and the wherewithal to move out. And just as he was doing so, his parents got sick, first his mom, then his dad, and they both died within about 6 months. And his dad, as he was dying, really wanted to impart this sort of handiness on his son, which he sort of did before he died. Dennis, the main character, the son, stayed in the house after his parents died and fixed it up. He was going to flip it. That was the plan. Wound up staying in the house and working on it slowly, transforming it for another 6-7 years. The whole time, having dreams about his parents, really sort of haunted by them, really wanted permission to leave. Anyway, over a couple years, 2-3 people who just came by told him that they thought the house was haunted. They were hearing things in a very specific spot. He thought it was bogus, whatever. One of them asked if they could bring in a ghost hunter, and he said sure, he had nothing to lose. And he recorded it, and it's this really beautiful tape of a guy sitting alone in the dark with flashlights that were set up to channel his parents. Having a conversation with his deceased mom and dad about whether or not he had their permission to leave and whether or not they were proud of him. Mm. It's a totally personal story. And when somebody pitched it, we were very unsure whether there was something in it that was for us. It's the opposite of science. And we imagined that people were going to be all over us for buying into this ghost story. But what we found in it, I think, was this larger question about how you move on and what you look for in your parents and how we're all really haunted by a whole host of things and how you deal with that.
Should you make that argument in your pitch, Lita? Like, if you're doing a personal story, I feel like at what point do you say this is more than just a personal story? Here's...
Well, for instance, I would say there's a lot of things in Debbie's pitch that the nation's haunted by. Mm-hmm. Slavery, civil rights, miscegenation, interracial dynamics, confronting the past of your family, denial, being honest. and going back. And I think if you took those big things and you framed it around her individual search till we got to, like, the reveal, you know, and then brought it into the present with your sign or what have you, you could have a fairly profound little journey there.
Yeah. So one question I have, so for Bob, so because a lot of these pitches that people are going to write to you guys are going to be written, do you start with the universal or do you start with a story and then get to the universal?
I would rather hear the story first.
Okay.
Because, as you know, because she has some incredible themes and big themes and important themes, but I mean, at the core, you know, we need to pull people in with a really gripping story. So I would rather hear that first and then hear what it all means. Because sometimes that comes up in the doing of the story anyway. You know, it sort of changes as the show goes on. And yeah, so I would probably want to hear the nuts and bolts of the story first.
Okay, great. All right. So up next, we have Anne Noyes. How do you say your full last name? Sorry, Anne Noyes. Okay, here we go.
Sani.
Sani, Anne Noyes Sani, who's going to be pitching Latino USA. Sorry, I'm really bad with names, incredibly bad
with
names.
That's okay. So. Nobody gets that name right.
Okay.
That's all right.
Yeah, so. Me too, so sorry. All right, so let me get my handy-dandy stopper going. Here, you set. All right, on your marks, get set, and go.
All right. So this is a story about immigration, which in itself is a sort of a transition in place and culture. But it's also a story about another kind of transition that involves your body and gender. And at this point, I would like to introduce the main character, and her name is Chanel International Lopez.
At the age of, like, 14, my mother sent me to the Dominican Republic because, you know, I needed to be a little bit more masculine. And, you know, she didn't like the fact that I was feminine. She didn't like how I said hi. She didn't like how I walk. So, you know, she sent me to my father to live over there, which was kind of torture. You know, living with 9 uncles and aunts who are all old school machismo, and the women are just as worse as the men. I've always knew I wanted to be a woman since I was 5. I mean, since back at the age of 5 years old, I said to myself, like, this is not me. Like, I don't like being a boy. I wasn't happy being a boy. I remember putting on my mother's heels. My mother used to hit me when she would walk in on me and see me with her heels on. It's not that she don't love me. It's just that she doesn't understand. I mean, she thinks that everybody is a tranny on RuPaul's Drag Race. And that's not the case. Those are men who dress up as women for show. They're illusionists, you know. So those are things that, you know, I have to explain to her. No, Mom, I'm not a drag queen. No, what you see on RuPaul's Drag Race is not what I live my life as.
Okay, so that was a montage of 3 clips of Chanel International Lopez. She's a transgender woman in the Bronx, but she started life as a Dominican boy growing up in East Harlem, and it wasn't easy for her to make that transition. She's now a well-known showgirl in gay clubs in New York, and she's also an activist in the LGBT community. And more recently, she has become a mother, and her kids, quote-unquote, are young gay men and transgender women, and she sort of adopts them, takes them under her wing, and guides them through their gender transition. And, you know, she does everything from sort of helping them find safe doctors to, you know, administering hormone shot, dating advice, and even talking with their families. When their families, especially Latino families, are not understanding why their son is becoming a woman, she tries to help them understand and take away the fear a little bit. Unfortunately, she didn't have anybody like that to help her. And so at this point in her life, she hasn't seen her father since she was 16, which is when she left the Dominican Republic. And he won't talk to her since she started her transition. And she tries to sort of have a relationship with her mom, but as you can hear in that clip, you know, they don't really understand each other. But what she has done is she's created her own family. She calls it her extended family, her gay family. And she's helped a younger generation of transgender men and women of color create a family and find acceptance as well. So I think it's an sort of feel-good story, sort of. And it's also, I think, important to see transgender people in stories that, you know, aren't about violence or discrimination or poverty or sex workers. So, you know, really, I think this is a story about a Latina mom and her kids.
Okay. Thank you.
I like it. We have done stories that have been similar in the past. We've done stories about transgendered immigrant women who have engaged in pumping, which is to enhance your breasts and your butt and all the things that...
I saw that story, yeah.
Yeah. And how it's very dangerous. And that was... Latino USA is structured around shows with particular themes, and that theme of that show was the queer show, and that was actually produced by an Audio Smut producer. Again, like the reason I like it is because part of the mission of Latino USA is not just to cover culture and news and issues that are pertinent to Latinos, but to bring in voices that we don't hear from a lot, especially in public radio, push that envelope that people have been talking about. And this is definitely an underreported story, a person that you don't hear a lot about. And I think you're right in the fact that often there's other negative associations brought to stories like this when somebody's so far beyond the pale of what's considered mainstream. Now, having said all that, I could see this story being something that could fit into a theme of home, family, creating new identities, that kind of thing. The way I think it would work would be, I guess I should be asking you this, but I should ask you, how would you make it work?
Right,
weaving the personal story in with the cultural context that you're talking about, the specific sort of machista thing that you can see in some traditional cultures.
Well, many of her kids are Latina, and so that would be part of it. Like, for instance, what I had hoped to do when I was sort of first talking with her this summer was to go to the Puerto Rican Day Parade with her, which is something she loves to do.
Is she Puerto Rican?
No,
she's Dominican.
She's Dominican, but yeah. She loves the Puerto Rican Day Parade. So there are ways to bring that in. The other sort of major thing that I thought would be interesting, she's a performer, she's a showgirl, and some mm-hmm. of her children are also performers, so she's sort of a mentor to them professionally in that respect. And in fact, tonight, actually, one of her children is having a big sort of debutante moment in the West Village, and it's sort of her coming out as a performer in that scene. So I have a friend who's going to be there backstage getting tape as they get ready, and you'll hear sort of mother and daughter getting ready and, you know, a few last words of advice before she goes out on stage, and then you'll hear, you know, the big introduction, you know, this is Princess Pierce Continental, that's the daughter. I guess basically I want to bring in, you know, the sound of their lives and then just them sort of reflecting on their family and their relationships.
How would you combine the micro and the macro, which is what's... I in stories that, like, are some of my favorites, mm-hmm. you have both of those elements. You have the very intimate, and then you've got the larger perspective around that. So how would you combine the micro thing, her story, the relationship with her children, with the larger perspective in terms of what they had to deal with in terms of the traditional culture, and whether minds are changing mm-hmm. because of people like her and the mentorship that she can provide.
Right. Well, what I would love to do, and I don't know if I could get this access, would be, I mean, so she has sort of worked with the biological mothers of some of her children to help them understand, you know, what is LGBT culture, what is transitioning, it's not that scary. I would love to get tape of her with one of those moms, because she said it's almost sort of like a co-mom thing, where like eventually the biological mom will be comfortable and will sort of call her up and be like, our child is misbehaving, what do we do? So it's like, you know, I mean, that would be great tape if I could get it. And a lot of these mothers are Latina, so then you would sort of, they also have a cultural commonality that maybe helps her to bridge the gap when she's helping these parents understand what, you know, the decision their children have made to transition.
I think you'd need that. Mm-hmm. You would need that, and you probably would need a male voice in there too, especially mm-hmm. if we're talking about transitioning from male to female and the machista culture coming, you know, being more visible among mm-hmm. men. You might want to look for a dad too. That would be strong. That would be a strong combination.
That's a really interesting idea. I hadn't considered that, but I was sort of thinking mom, mother, woman,
yeah.
But
because the male perspective would be, you know, sort of another missing link there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no. So I was curious. So are you like green light? Go.
I like this story. Not just because it's unusual and it's people that you don't usually hear from, but because it's positive and because it sort of stretches our definition of what it is to be family, what it is to be a mentor, and has the larger thing going on in terms of the culture adjusting to these different identities. Having said that, I am not the sole decider, as W would say.
Right.
So, but I would say pitch.
Yeah. Right, so you're giving it a green light. You are giving it.
I like it. I mean, I can hear it. The one thing I would probably want to talk to you more about is what kind of Ambi we're going to get. Not just the personal stories, but the Puerto Rican Day Parade is a nice, place to get Ambi. Any scenes at home, if there's, you know, the family, the parents, that you can get the showgirl scene, you know, the street, whatever. Like, you can make this story. Maybe not even go dry at all, or if it does go dry, it's for a specific purpose. It's like a very poignant moment or something.
Yeah.
So that's the other piece that I think I'd want to flesh out with you.
All right, well done. Oops, sorry. So Lita, I totally forgot, and my apologies. I wanted you to say, so just talk about your show and what kind of stories that you guys look for.
Well, see, this pitch is a nice segue from that, because the first thing I would say is Latino USA, although it focuses on issues that are relevant to Latinos and that reflect Latino life and culture, just because there's Latinos in a story does not make it a Latino USA story. It's got to have more in it, which is a nice example of this particular pitch because there was so much more in it. And having said that also, the show looks for places where the Latino culture intersects with other cultures. For instance, one of my personal favorite stories that I edited is about something called Mambo Nix. And I'm a Jew-Rican, so my mom was Puerto Rican, my father was Jewish, and I grew up in New York, and my father was always late, and he liked to dance, and my mother was like, be on time. And so much for stereotypes, right? But anyway, I love this story because, for instance, it was about how mambo and salsa were this big craze in New York in the 1950s, and the Jews loved it. And the Jews and the blacks and the Puerto Ricans and maybe some whites all danced like at a club, like at the Palladium Club in the 1950s together, and, you know, peace, love, and harmony and all that. So that's one example of a nice story where we're looking at how the Latino culture intersects with other cultures. We recently did a show on Asian-Latino intersection, and we've got one planned on Afro-Latino. So there's, you know, an effort to really, as I said, bring in voices other than what is in the conventional mainstream, just bring different perspectives in. We do also, just as a caveat, take stories from abroad if there's a strong U.S. connection that listeners here can relate to. I think that's it. Okay.
All right. So I want to pose again a question to everyone. So how important, so, you know, you asked Bob Debbie if she had already had tape of her kind of doing this journey, and Anne, you know, noted that she was, even though she's here, it sounded like, Anne, you were getting tape of this event? Right. Yeah. How much tape do you expect people to have before they pitch to you? What do you recommend?
Well, they don't have to have tape, but you know, my show is more of a story show than a news show, and so it's almost never the case where someone has an idea that's only a concept, and then I say, yeah, go see what story you can find. I mean, usually when someone pitches a story to me, they know what the story is already, for the most part. And so even if they don't have specifically, they don't have the tape, they will know, they have a pretty clear idea of what the tape is going to be. But when people pitch me and they have tape, and especially if it gives me the idea of like what their main character sounds like and how good of a talker they are and that kind of thing, it's very helpful. And it gives me, you know, if somebody has an idea and it's a good idea and then they have some tape and the character's really good, it's probably going to be something I would want to do.
Jamie, does tape ever hurt? Like, have you had a situation where somebody's pitched and says, I have all this tape, and then you hear it and you're like, oh, this story's amazing, and then you hear the tape and you're like, wow, whoops.
No, I can't think of a case where that's happened, but okay. That would certainly be a deal breaker. I mean, if they had tape to play and it just wasn't that interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's probably the wrong time to say this, but we've got like a 3-part approval process. And we will...
Wait, what?
Yeah, sorry. We take pitches at meetings. The group informally weighs in on the pitches before the group discusses them, and so it's entirely possible that your pitch could wither before it ever makes it to the group discussion. We often greenlight pitches, but then expect that 2 or 3 interviews will be done and people will have listened to the best parts of those interviews and given feedback before we finally greenlight the story, and the story continues past there. So the tape has everything to do with how successful the story is going to be, and we can say yes to an idea, but it has everything to do with.
Do you pay people during that process? Like, if you have agreed to do that, so you pay people during that process.
Absolutely.
So they're okay.
Yeah.
I guess too. I mean, Radiolab has such a distinctive sound and tone and style that how does the producer fit in that? Like, you know, how much are they? You know,
the outside contributor.
Yeah, like that.
It runs the gamut, and we've been opening up the pitch process more and more to outside contributors and negotiating just that. And I feel like for everybody, it's a different conversation. It has everything to do with how much they want to be involved, for starters. But if they want to be involved throughout the process, then what I think we're realizing works best is for them to be very present for the interviews, for the what we call selecting, so pulling the best bits from those interviews and putting them up for kind of group appraisal. And then we do what we call storyboarding. We sort of follow a movie model more than a radio model. And we come up with a very rough outline that we then break into parts, and we have different producers work on different parts of a single story. Mm-hmm. And it's at that point that the sort of production machinery kicks in, and an outside producer is probably less useful and probably wants to be involved less because that process is so idiosyncratic to us. But the creation of the storyboard, we do a simultaneous mood board, another sort of film thing we've borrowed. We love the producer to be there, and that's where they can bring their kind of reporterly expertise to bear and really help us shape this thing that we're really responding to emotionally and roughly.
All right, and speaking of outside producers who are pitching to Radiolab, Jake, come on up. All right, Jake Harper.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm nervous, but great. So
you're going to be fine.
Thank you. Thank
I'm
you.
Nervous, too.
Paul Galani was forced to eject from his plane and come down in enemy territory in Vietnam during the Vietnam War. And he was captured and led to an infamous prison known as the Hanoi Hilton. He was placed in a 5-by-7-foot cell. A bamboo mat covered the window, so it was dark, and he was kept completely isolated from other prisoners for several days. And the Vietnamese used these isolation tactics to break the will of their prisoners. If anyone was caught passing notes or talking, they were severely beaten or they were placed in shackles and ropes as punishment. But a few days into his stay, or several days into his stay there, Paul Galani found out that the prisoners weren't totally helpless against these tactics. And just a quick note about my tape, it's phone tape from a pre-interview, so it's pretty low quality. But
do you want to play that?
Yeah, okay. That one, please.
And TR is UR would be thanks.
So what you just heard was the tap code. If you imagine a 5x5 grid with one letter per square, excluding the letter K, prisoners could use this grid and tap out letters and words and sentences to communicate across the concrete walls of their cells. So once Galani was able to learn the code and use it proficiently, he was transported from this dark reality of his cell, and he was plugged into a vast network of prisoners across the camp. They were able to spread messages about pending interrogations so that they could mentally prepare and strategize about what they would say to the Vietnamese. They were able to keep a roster of all the men that were in the camp, so if someone went missing, they would know, or if someone were to be sent home, they could give an accurate depiction of who was left in the camp. But most importantly, the code just allowed these guys to talk to one another. They shared jokes. They wrote poems using the code. And they shared stories. And they even eventually figured out a way to improvise laughter by sort of scratching on the wall. By doing this, it allowed them to get through some pretty tough times. And if you could play cut two.
And the only thing he played that in English on our PA system was anti-American propaganda. It was all anti-war stuff. And to keep away from that, because after it's all over, we tap a big Bravo Sierra BS to the guys next door. And it pumps you up a little bit just doing that. I mean, if you lose communication, that causes all kinds of problems because you just feel like you're all by yourself. And then they had several people who just went off the deep end and ended up cooperating, and it was really a bad scene. So that's really what kept us going. It was lifeblood. That's the one thing they tried to stop, and they never could.
So, Jimmy, so what would make this, like, so let's pretend like that story doesn't exist?
We didn't use that story for a recent translation show because it didn't, partly it was about what it was going to sit beside, and we had a bunch of stories about language, and we wanted to get away from that idea, literal translation. But this has some things that perhaps that doesn't. So I open the window of possibility back up again and say it's not a fait accompli that we'll use that story, and it takes this one's place. But what I've wondered about both is, beyond the adapting to incredibly difficult circumstances, what about the communication surprises you? I mean, what surprised me and what made me lean forward after the initial hook of the knocking was jokes and poems. Like, how do humor is such a complicated thing. To literally knock Anna Karenina is wildly complicated and time-consuming. But I'm interested in all the other kinds of communication that you can nonetheless convey when you're limited to knocking on the wall. Joke seems impossible. Poetry seems even more impossible. And the fact that you would laugh at a joke, while I understand the instinct, I'd be really curious about someone breaking down what that actually means. Can you laugh harder or less hard? Can you laugh at certain nuance and not other nuance? But I'm curious, what about it beyond the knocking surprised you?
I didn't realize, so that there's a lot of, this has been reported before, not in depth. But the thing that, I guess I just never paid attention to this story, and I found it in a book in the library, basically. And what, I mean, the idea that you can form a human connection with someone just through sound and by tapping on a wall, I mean, that's just insane to me. But it also mirrors a lot of things that we see today. People form relationships online, and in a lot of cases, I mean, depending on how much information you have on your Facebook profile, like, it could be just as mysterious that way. And the way that the tap code was able to replace written notes, which got them in trouble. I don't know. There's a lot of things that interest me about it.
How did they teach each other the language?
So it started with a guy named Smitty Harris, and there was some. I think just after about several months of being isolated, they were shuffling people around. He got placed in a cell with two people for a couple of days, and he recalled this lesson from one of his flight training schools and it was unique to him. He had hung back after a lesson, and the professor sort of explained this code to him in more detail. Everyone else, I think, had assumed it was Morse code, but it actually wasn't. It was this grid system. Mm-hmm. And because he knew that, he was able to teach it to these men, and they thought it would be useful. And then from then on, they scratched it into walls. And Smitty Harris actually told me a story of how he taught it to another man just by tapping on the wall. He tapped 26 letters for the alphabet, and he eventually, I mean, they started out using just one number per letter of the alphabet, and I guess they eventually strung enough letters together to get that whole message across.
And do you have a sense for how he felt about the language? I mean, did he in some way fall in love with the limitation? I'm curious if he developed a relationship with the thing he was reduced to.
For Smitty Harris, I'm not sure. I wasn't able to talk to him for a super long time. I read a book by a guy named Gerald Coffey, who was also in this prison with them, and he talks about his relationship with the code in great detail. I can't quote it from memory or anything, but yeah. He talks about he talks about the love that he feels for these men, despite the fact that they're communicating in these really broken down sentences that are, I mean, a lot of it's similar to text messaging, what you heard tweet. There, but they took it to a step beyond text messaging where, you know, I mean, it's a lot of military acronyms and things like that, but... yeah, they had to develop a relationship with this code because that's what they were doing all day.
Yeah. And do you know what happened to it after they left? They all left at once? It sounds like they all got out.
Yeah, they all got out. As far as I know, they all got out at once. There are a few that left early, which is what made keeping the roster useful. But they all got out at once, and now there are a few other sort of funny... in interesting ways that they would communicate in addition to this code. They also developed a way, it's the same grid system, but they would use coughs and sneezes to do it instead. They also had some, I guess, can I curse? Am I allowed to curse?
Yes.
They would sneeze words like horse shit and rat shit in response to the propaganda stuff. So those were some other things they would do. But they also had sort of a sign language that they would use if they did get visual contact. Sorry.
We have to wrap this conversation up.
Yeah. I should say it was a really strong pitch. I mean, the thing that we look for as a baseline is a character, you know, it's the classic story. It's a character going through something and changing emotionally. And you delivered that from the jump. So my compliments for that. Yeah, and I, you know, it's a strong yellowy green. but for this other thing, we'd have to reckon with.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. All right. So I just want to take just 2 minutes before we open it up to the floor. So one question that I had for everyone on the panel here is that we have the luxury of being able to have this dialogue. You don't have that in a written pitch. You know, what is it that do you ever call people back like with this and ask and have that dialogue? And what makes you call them back that the story is like that good? I mean, like how much?
Yeah, I mean, we do it all the time. Or there's some element of it that doesn't seem to have been teased out in the way that ultimately we tease it out in the meeting, for example, when we all discuss what we're most interested in.
Mm. So people should, because I've had this before, I think, sometimes where you've somebody comes back to you and says, hey, you know, we're kind of interested, but what about this? And I feel like that's almost as important, if not more important, than the pitch, is kind of the answering of that question.
Yeah, and sometimes that's something that you can do in writing or by doing a little more research. And sometimes, like we were saying, it's going and getting tape and seeing if there's something hot in the tape that helps answer the question that we all have and makes the worth of it self-evident.
Okay. Lita, did you want to say anything before I open it up?
I do that fairly frequently where I think there's something in there that could be interesting or different or useful. And I like to talk to people myself because it helps me see how they think. And also sometimes questions will arise in the course of a conversation that you may not get necessarily in just a written pitch or an email conversation. So I find that pretty useful. And something I actually do like to do, I find a lot as an editor, is that people will tell you the gee whiz in it when you're talking about it, like what is psyching them about this story. And I'll actually take notes and keep that and then come back to it when I'm editing it, because sometimes, you know, what somebody saw, and more, and you know, and this happened too, and you know what else? This thing. And it's the most remarkable thing in the story, and that can be forgotten once you've, like, put it all together and logged all your tape and you've structured the whole thing. And so I actually will do that. I will take notes from an initial conversation and go back to that when I'm editing the actual piece, because sometimes there's initial things in there that are really cool. And I don't think you can do that as well without an oral conversation. So,
Bob, did you have anything to add?
No, not so much. It's similar to what what they were saying. And I deal a lot in email. almost whole process is email. But yeah, I mean, if it's especially if it's going to be somebody who's going to be a part of the story, especially if they're going to be a character in the story, and I want to get a sense of them, then yeah, talking to them on the phone is definitely. What they were saying, calling the gee whiz moment, you know, because a lot of times when people listen to a story, they aren't even really always responding to the entire story. They're responding often to a moment, that there's always some moment that everybody remembers from a story. And sometimes somebody's pitch will have that moment, but there's something wrong with the rest of the story. And then, so sometimes, like, I want to save that moment, and then you may go back and forth and figure out, like, how can we make this work, even when, so similar.
Great. So I want to open it up to questions. You can come down to the mic. Look at everybody rushing. I know this is like being recorded. It's like mass amounts of people heading over to the mic right now. It's insane. You guys, be careful. Don't trample over each other. Say your name.
Oh, sorry. Nellie Gillis. I work for Radio Diaries. But in terms of pitching, how quickly do you guys tend to get back to the pitches? And I think that for a lot of us, if we're pitching new shows that we haven't pitched before, we might have sort of a lofty goal of where we want our story to go, and if they don't take it, we have stories that we want to pitch it to afterwards, but we don't want to pitch it to a show and then sort of say to them, actually, those guys responded, and we'd rather it go there. So I sort of do a wave of pitches, and I just don't want to pitch it to the second wave unless I know that I'm going to have no's from the first. So I guess, sort of, do you get back to everyone, and if so, what's your timeline like?
We'll just go that way.
Good. I'm ashamed to say that if I like the pitch, I will respond almost immediately. And I, unlike these guys, I am the only decision maker. If I'm excited about something, I will I will respond within minutes. And if I don't, if I have concerns, I will think about it for a while. And I know that's a horrible situation to put people into. I know just like you said, you're probably pitching it to a few people. And that was one of the things I was going to also say in terms of do's and don'ts is the idea of being patient, because all these editors have lots of stuff on their plates, to be patient, but also politely insistent. And if you haven't heard from somebody in a couple of days, you know, just check-in message is fine, as long as you're not obnoxious. But yeah.
Can you, you know, this is interesting. Give me just like a quick example of a not obnoxious check-in.
Not obnoxious?
That's just like, oh. Hey, like what would you say?
Just hi, just checking in. Make you know, wanted to find out if you had a chance to look over my pitch yet. Is all. Yeah.
There you go. We'll write that down.
And okay. I would just add, I've got three other places that I'd really like to pitch it. So if you're not interested, that's fine. I just need to know.
Yeah. Oh, so it's okay. Because sometimes I wonder, like, do you say, like, hey, I'm sending this off, or do you think some editors find that offensive?
I don't find it offensive. I totally understand the situation in which you're trying to make a living, and this is your currency. So, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, ditto. It's not offensive at all. I mean, and, you know, for anybody who was a reporter before they were an editor or whatever, you get that.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Uh-huh.
Hi, my name's Scott. I'm a student, and...
Hi, Scott.
over the summer, I did a story for NPR's Here and Now about playing the cello. And what my producer did when he pitched it was he tied the story to this study about, it's like some new study about playing music and the brain. And so I was wondering how important it is when you pitch a story to tie it to some relevant news.
News peg.
For me, not at all, really. It's only a coincidence if mine have a news peg, just because I work slowly because, you know, with small staff, and I think of my shows more as evergreen. I try to do my shows sort of to have, you know, repeat listening value. So a lot of times people put a news peg in it when they pitch me stuff, but it doesn't, for me, just personally, my show specifically, it doesn't have any really matter. I mean, unless there's a way so that it can be timed that way, like the news peg is 6 months in the future or something. And but other than that, like, you know, like a few weeks out or something, I can't do that.
Can we just get, because it looks like we've got people up in the mic, can we just get thumbs down, up or down on news peg, thumbs up?
I'm allergic to news pegs.
Okay.
we'll take
both.
I'm
allergic to them, yeah.
Latino USA will take both.
Okay. All right. So we have allergic on two ends and both in the middle. Right. Are you allergic, Bob? You're not allergic. 6 months down the road, like, you need to be a little bit prescient.
It would be cool if it happened. I mean, occasionally it's happened, but okay. It's always a coincidence.
All right. Got it. Okay.
Hi, I'm Allison, and I'm a freelancer. Mm-hmm. Are there any stories that you've been thinking to yourself, gosh, I wish somebody would really pitch us something on this? And conversely, is there anything that you've heard that you're like, dear God, never pitch us anything like this ever again? We're so sick of it. Thank you.
Subway musicians, couch surfing.
Nothing's jumping out.
Oh, come on. That's a lie.
Well, the never's easy.
Oh, the never's easy? Okay.
I don't want a neuroscience study. I think I started that way. But no, what we're hoping for is surprise. So that obviously speaks for itself.
Okay. Yeah, what's the never?
I'm not a fan of what I call zoo stories, like, hey, look, there's Latinos living in such and such place or whatever. and with respect, it's not as uncommon as you would think, you know. There has to be more to the story. So.
Yeah, and actually also sometimes there's the people that do something crazy just to get to make a story out of it, like, oh, I lived in an aquarium for a month or something, you know, unless something unexpected happened while you were in the aquarium.
I grew gills.
Yeah.
So, okay. I became Aqua Woman. Would you take that?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Another green light for the AR Getting TS pitch panel. All right.
Hey there, Manoush. I'm the host of New Tech City.
Hey.
On the flip side, I'm starting to do more commissioning, which is why I wanted to sit and see what you guys are asking. So I have two questions. One of them is not so nice. The first one is, how many commissions do you have on the go, like, in a roster? And then my second question is, has this ever happened that, like, you commission something and the tape is great, but the reporter is just not bringing it? I have never had to do this, but I'm sort of girding myself. Can you say to them, your tape's awesome, can we work something out that we make a show with it? I know that's weird, and I apologize for you.
So it's like not killing, but like, we love your tape.
Yeah.
You, Okay, let's just be real. We're getting real on the air pitch panel.
I have a feeling about that. I feel like it's the editor's job to bring out the editor doesn't just help the reporter. The editor helps the story and finds the soul of the story. And if you can do that with the reporter, everybody wins. So that's not to say that situations like that don't arise, but it's also to say before you get to that point, is it really hopeless? You know, because most people who, if you can gather awesome tape, then you have some sense of having a good story. So me personally, I would probably lean towards working it more before I would say, well, we're just going to take your tape, unless it just doesn't, it's not suited for a feature story. It's just much better as a host tape and copy or something for that format. But not because the editor should be willing to work to make the story happen.
I have 20 stories I'm currently working on at the one time. I just counted. The way I work is I have varying degrees of work that I do on the stories. Some are handed to me almost done. That's the rarest. More often than it's, there's some degree of people handing me all the voice tracks edited, and then I turn those into a story. I kind of really lean toward non-narrated stuff. I've definitely told people that you have to take yourself out of it. That some people they want to be in the story and they have no reason to be in the story. They just want, they found the story and they feel passionate about it, so they want to put themselves in as a narrator when they don't need to be. That had that happen. I think in general people want their story to be on and they want to get the work and there's a way to gently remove them. Yeah.
Jamie, did you want anything?
Jamie, don't even answer that. We're in the midst of something anyway.
So. Right, yeah. You guys can talk about it on the ninth floor.
All right.
Yeah. All right.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for being here. I'm Daniel Gross. I'm an independent producer. So one of the things that I hear from organizations I pitch to is that they can hear the story. Bob and I have talked about this. When they're reading the pitch. And what I wonder often is how much should I structure the story as I imagine it playing out? Because there are times when...
Oh, wait, I just want to clarify because it's something I think I was thinking about. So are you saying, like, in your written pitch, you should say, I imagine a 3-minute blah, 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 or...
Not so specific as, like, here's how long it's going to be, or here's what music I'd use, but...
Yeah.
Rarely are our final products actually chronological. Mm-hmm. And so should you say, the story opens with this sound and person, or this scene, and then develop it as that non-chronological pitch? Or are we trying to deliberately give something a little bit in the raw, in the sense that you want the person who reads it to feel encouraged to shape it themselves? Mm. So I know this is a highly personal question. It may change or may be different for all of you, but I wanted to get some thoughts.
I mean, I think in the pitch process, I think it helps to just be chronological, just to get a sense of the story, and then in the working with it, then you can kind of play with the structure and things like that. Yeah. Mm.
Jamie?
I would say you want from the pitch the same thing that hopefully the story is going to deliver. So if you can structure the pitch in such a way that I'm hooked from the jump, but it isn't chronological, that's fine by me. I mean, that is what I assume will carry over into the radio version. And chronology doesn't bother me on the radio. Whether I'm interested bothers me on the radio.
It's sometimes useful to know what kind of structure the reporter is thinking about. And, actually you can... If I was looking at a pitch, I could say, there's something good in there, but I wouldn't quite structure it that way, or let me talk to the reporter about that. So I feel like if you have a clear sense of what you want in the structure, put it in your pitch, but it's not necessary. What's more necessary is the idea and all the things around it that we've been talking about.
And I'd also be as transparent with us as hopefully we are with you, which is to say you don't know exactly, but your hunch is that you would do it this way. And we'll do the same when we take you out of your piece.
Okay. Yeah. That was super sly. Nice. All right, last question. Right. Wait, who?
Well, I was just going to say, especially if you're going to give some suggestions, be sort of like open and collaborative about your suggestions. Don't make it seem like this is the way it's going to be, because we want to feel like we can work with you also. Mm-hmm.
Is that first sentence the most important sentence in a pitch? If people, should they really like the first two sentences, like the hook?
No. I mean, no? I'm actually, okay. I'm more interested that people have thought through what the sort of emotional heart of it is than that they have a ripping good first sentence. And then
so you're more attracted to the story rather than clever writing?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. And, okay. and people 100%. Come and pitch us in person, and it is awfully often wildly different. Mm. I mean, they're not producing an essay. Mm-hmm. They're producing a radio piece, and so I want them to have thought it through, and that might come out vocally or might come out in the written word.
Okay, great. Last question.
Hi, I'm Emily.
Hi, Emily.
Hi, I cover the oil boom in North Dakota for Inside Energy, which is a multimedia journalism collaborative. And I'm sure some of us have had the experience of pitching a show, being rejected, and then seeing a story very similar to ours air by someone on staff at some point in the future. As freelancers, should we be afraid that if we get rejected, something like that could happen? And advice for freelancers if you feel like that's happened to you?
Hmm. Everybody's now looking at me. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, at Latino USA, we will pay an idea fee if that's the case. Yeah. It's not a lot. It's $75, but it's a way of showing respect for, thank you. You know, we would like to use this.
And what if 2 years down the road you hear a version that's much, much better and you want to run with that one? But she brought it up first.
2 years down the road?
Is that what you're referring to?
I guess I'm saying, like, if I pitch something, I don't know about the time frame. Like, I don't know when your idea expires, you know, and it's fair game.
Yeah.
But it's more, I guess, so it would be, like, let's say within the next year or so, if you feel like, hey, that was my story, that was my angle, and this show that I pitched.
That's really hard. I've never run into a situation where someone's come to us and said, I think you just did my story.
Right. I don't think that's ever happened.
And I'm a big believer in, you know, I mean, Kryptonesia. Yeah, I think there are ideas out there.
If it's the same story, the same angle, the same... Because I can imagine that somebody pitching something a year later that's similar, but it's just kind of strikes me more. But if it was literally the same, you know, the same... You know, that similar, I can't imagine that happening.
But it sounds like the finder's fee idea. I mean, is that something that your other, you guys do, if you like the idea, but want to do it yourselves?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, part of it, too, is that a show needs a reputation that they deal well with people. And that's part of it, too. It's the right thing to do, and it's also a pragmatic thing to do. And because you want good ideas to keep coming, so... Mm-hmm.
All right, so here, so we have come to the end, but I have one final thing. How often do your pitch sessions happen? Like, are they weekly? How often do they happen? When do they happen? So when should people pitch you? On a Monday? On a Tuesday? The 15th of the month? When?
Ours are every Friday from 11:30 to 1, so Thursday night we put things in the pitch doc, gives people a chance to look at them, think about them.
Okay.
Latino USA, it's Friday afternoons, and we try our best to get back to people early the following week, or at least within the week. I am not the person to pitch to. The pitch address is pitches@futuromediagroup.org. And if I have cards and stuff, I can give people if they want.
Yeah, and so then we'll
ask
people.
Yeah, mine is almost exclusively email, so if people... email me all the time. It's just unfictional@kcrw.org.
When is your pitch meeting with yourself?
All the time.
Okay. All right, Jamie, so where should people pitch to if they're sending pitches?
Pitch to me.
Okay.
JYORK@WNYC.org.
Okay, great. Well, all right, everybody, go forth.